In last night's State of the Union address, President Obama claimed that the Taliban's momentum has been broken in Afghanistan. And if that's true, it's probably safe to say that General David Petraeus had a lot to do with our success there. Many have called the soldier, scholar, diplomat the most significant warrior since Eisenhower, and Tom Brokaw suggests he may be the most important American of our time. Now, Paula Broadwell, a research associate at Harvard's Center for Public Leadership, has co-authored a book with Vernon Loeb that examines General Petraeus' service in the Army, and in it she explains how he came to form strategies that helped shift the momentum in both Iraq and Afghanistan. All In, The Education of David Petraeus, is published by the Penguin Press, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Paula Broadwell to our show today. Hello.
Thanks for having me, Leonard.
You say that General Petraeus has an open-door policy and is known for networking and encouraging officers and academics to email him their ideas. Is this something common for an official in his kind of position?
I think it's quite atypical for a military officer, given that we work in a hierarchical organization. But I think it's one of his keys to success, and he has great situational awareness. He's served as a strategic commander, but he is in the know about what's going on in a tactical situation on the ground because he reaches out to all those different nodes. So he kind of is on a quest for infotopia, or he does crowdsourcing, if you will. That is atypical.
Do you think that he's still doing it now that he's heading the CIA?
He sure is. It's interesting to see that he's still tapping into his military networks, academic networks. And I sort of would categorize him as a maven or a connector. He likes to encourage people to exchange information, but he often benefits from it when he does that.
He also goes against the whole hierarchical aspect of the military, doesn't he? He decides who he wants to put trust in and who he doesn't, depending on rank.
That's true. One example is his commander's initiative group in Afghanistan. While he was serving there, he had a group of about 10 individuals, civilians and military officers. And rank didn't necessarily matter, but if they had a good idea, he would bring them in. And most of them had high-level graduate degrees and so on, not necessarily accomplished on the battlefield, but each of them brought a different sort of niche to the team.
Well, he talks about how important mentors were for him, and you get a feeling that he feels that he owes a certain responsibility to the people who are going to follow him.
That's right. He has the sort of pay it forward attitude. And he realizes that he had mentors looking out for him. He has a very large personality and probably would have and has offended a few people along the way because of his ambitions in the military. But he had mentors that saw his potential and mentored him and guided him. And now he tries to do that to so many others. And
like General Galvin, for example.
General Galvin was the key influential role player in his life, and they still stay in touch. And I have an interesting story about their relationship. General Galvin tried to teach him about the image of a commander and how you're supposed to inspire the troops. All commanders try to do that, obviously. But he encouraged Petraeus to develop a mythology or mystique about himself, and he referenced Patton and his cigars and other leaders who had these sort of symbolic ways of leading. Petraeus has used symbology, too, to inspire and mentor others. He has this picture, a Remington picture of the Stampede, if you're familiar with it, and that's how he's kind of symbolized his command.
He doesn't own the original painting. He has a print of it that Galvin gave him.
He had a print that Galvin gave him when he was a major, when he was actually he was a captain. He was leaving Galvin's command at Fort Stewart. He has a print on his wall now at the CIA. It's not an original, but it was done by another artist. And he uses it. He used it on his first day speech at the CIA. He's used it in every one of his commands. And it shows what he's trying to show is that he's comfortable in chaos. He can deal with the cattle and the herd being sort of, spread in all different directions and thunder and lightning, and he can carry on.
Now, Galvin referred to the mythology as the Big M.
That's right, the Big M. And so
could have been the Big I for image, right?
It could have, but now I was fortunate to look at letters the two had exchanged over decades, and that offered a lot of insights into their relationship and really what Galvin's role was in mentoring Petraeus on everything from counterinsurgency to this type of image to understanding military history. And so Galvin is Big M and Petraeus is Little M, but I think he's probably graduated and moved up now.
Well, Custer had the long hair and the beard and certain other things that he affected. You mentioned Patton, who not only had the cigars but had the holstered pistol by his side. What has Petraeus done?
I think the key thing.
I mean, other than carrying around a print of a Remington painting.
There are many many examples I could use. He's really known as a fitness buff, and he can run 6 to 7 minute miles for 10 miles. He can do 125 sit-ups, no problem, and push-ups, you know, 100 push-ups in less than 2 minutes. And so this kind of fitness fanaticism, but he considers his body the ultimate weapon system, and that's something he's long said since he was a young lieutenant, and he's tried to encourage his troopers to do the same. And you can understand, an infantryman needs to be fit to fight, and mental wellness, I think, has something to do with physical wellness as well. So the whole fitness sort of image is important for his myth, if you will, his mythology.
Well, he's not insisting that people do all of those push-ups after basic training.
He insists anyone he comes across gives it a try. He has encouraged his some people in his social network, like his tailor, people he works with, to lose weight and get fit. And you see how he kind of brings energy to the team. And that's one of his leadership philosophy or mantras, that you need to be someone who gives energy, who isn't an oxygen thief, if you will.
The book is really about his entire military career. Why have you given it the subtitle, The Education of David Petraeus?
That's an excellent question. What I tried to examine was the variables that influenced his beliefs in counterinsurgency. Why did he come to believe so strongly that counterinsurgency could work in Iraq? And I looked at three sort of categories. I looked at the role of his mentors and basically his whole social network. So that may include, you know, seniors, but also peers and subordinates. I looked at his education, both his West Point education and the traditional professional military schools he went to. Command and General Staff College, for example. And then his civilian education. He went to Princeton, as you know, and got a PhD. And that experience that he calls out of his intellectual comfort zone experience really broadened his horizons. And that's something he tries to get his mentees to do, too. So his mentors and social network, his education, and then his experiences. And I sort of document throughout the book when he is exposed, whether it's, you know, through a mentor or something he's reading, or he spent time in Central America looking at these insurgencies, for example, when he's exposed to these certain variables and how it influenced his thinking. So it was all part of his education.
Aren't you also a West Point graduate?
I am, yes.
You spent time serving in the military, worked in counterterrorism. Do you think that gave you some kind of insight into this subject that a civilian biographer might not have had?
I think so, and I think that's why this book is unique. It's uniquely informed. I came at it from a very different angle, different experience than the other writers who have written about Petraeus. And I could write about the West Point experience. I could write about the counterterrorism experience, the interagency experience that we profile. I had done peacekeeping and nation building myself. And so, I'm informing it from a firsthand perspective. On the other hand, I was able to tap into my social network in Afghanistan when I went there and embedded. And I went every couple of months for about 3 weeks at a time. I think I spent about 3 months on the ground with him and with the troops. But these were some of my classmates. Four of my classmates were his personal aides. So, you know, I could get, again, a perspective from them. And then several of my classmates or friends from West Point were battalion commanders with whom I embedded. And so I drew upon my experience, my social network, to inform the book.
Well, we've talked about embedding in the past, and there's always the danger of a bonding with your subject, becoming a partisan reporter. And you obviously admired David Petraeus.
I don't think anything's wrong with that. I have a lot of respect for what he's done and the service he's contributed to our nation. And this book is really what it is at the end of the day is a story about our values, our being the military. And it's a picture of strategic leadership. And I don't think I'm that biased towards him in the book. I really present war as ugly as it is. And here are the facts, and you can decide for yourself.
Well, not everyone in the military admires him. Rolling Stone's Michael Hastings reported in his new book that members of the military had nicknamed him General Petraeus long before MoveOn.org did.
I'd never heard that. But he does have his detractors, and I do write about that in the book. He is an extremely competitive person. I like to see that in you know, any trooper, and you can imagine as a president looking at, you know, someone you want to put in charge of your military fight, you want them to be competitive. And he's competitive towards his peers. He's competitive towards the enemy. He likes to win. So I haven't come across anyone who said that. I've interviewed skeptics of Petraeus and, you know, Petraeophiles, if you will. But he, I can understand how his ambition and his kind of driven nature would offend some.
Well, he had a different kind of nickname when he was growing up, didn't he?
Peaches, yes.
That doesn't sound very competitive.
Well, he didn't give it to himself. That was from the time he was an Eagle Scout, I think someone gave him that name.
Well, in their notorious ad, MoveOn claimed that he played fast and loose with the facts, and then the Washington Post fact checker looked into it and they said, yeah, he had to kind of played fast and loose with some of the facts, making claims that were rather exaggerated about his success. Is that all part of the big M?
That's an interesting way of phrasing it. I don't think so. If you look at the metrics, and you know, you can use metrics however you want. I think that's what you're implying, and that's what the reporter was implying. But the facts are that he did implement the surge, and violence started to go down, and now we're able to remove troops, as you can see. So I would dispute that he was intentionally misleading the press, and I think that, you know, the facts later, if you look at the Brookings Institute index of statistics on operations in Iraq, would prove that he was accurate and truthful.
General William McChrystal was fired as the commander of operations in Afghanistan in 2010 after he and his staff made some controversial remarks about President Obama to Michael Hastings. But he also expressed resentment about the credit that Petraeus took for many things he felt he had done in Iraq and Afghanistan. And he felt he was really more the guy on the ground than Petraeus.
Well, I interviewed General McChrystal a couple of times, and actually I worked for him in the summer of 2009 when he was doing his assessment in Afghanistan. I never heard him say anything pejorative towards Petraeus. He never said anything like that to me. So if your information was from Michael Hastings, I would question it.
You don't think Michael Hastings reported fairly?
I don't know. I think there's some question about that. It may be true. I know that General McChrystal, in my interviews with him, was very fair towards Petraeus, and Petraeus quite often was very verbal about giving support to General McChrystal. In fact, in his first day speech in the command in Afghanistan in front of the situation room, he expressed his regret about McChrystal's departure and gave him high praise for everything he had established and set in motion before he got there. And he still does. In fact, he 6 months into his command in Afghanistan, he still had General McChrystal listed as a key input for the resources that we were pouring into Afghanistan. So I would counter Michael Hastings' point of view on that.
You haven't read the piece, obviously.
I've skimmed it. Yes, I know what he said about Petraeus in there. I have a different perspective, obviously.
Paula Broadwell has written with Vernon Loeb a look at General Petraeus, all in The Education of General David Petraeus, which is published by Penguin. And this is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Vernon Loeb, whose name is in smaller type, so obviously he did some of the work, but he's a Washington Post reporter who also was embedded with Petraeus at one point.
He is the metro editor for Washington Post, and he had embedded with General Petraeus's troops in the 101st Airborne Division while they were stationed in Mosul, Iraq. So he had some experience with Petraeus. He'd been a war correspondent out of the Pentagon for some years, so he was used to the lexicon. And he sort of shared my philosophy about the approach to the book and was instrumental in kind of shaping the arc of the narrative, if you will. And he's also a runner, so he fit in with the team.
You open your book with events that took place on the day Petraeus was named as McChrystal's replacement. What was his reaction to the news that he would be replacing McChrystal?
Well, he found out before his drive to the White House that he was being considered. He'd received a call from Stanley McChrystal the night that the Rolling Stone article was coming out, and he had a bad feeling about it. He then received a call from Admiral Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and Mullen said, "You're probably going to be in consideration for this." Now, if you remember, the news media was speculating about General Mattis and several other officers that could replace him, and Petraeus's name was never thrown up on the television screen. But when he got to the White House, he was waiting for a meeting that had already been scheduled, and he was beckoned by one of the president's assistants to come up to the Oval Office, and he knew then that probably it was his turn to go. So he was sad about McChrystal leaving. He feared a loss of momentum. And yet, on the other hand, I think he would probably say that there was a bit of a violation of civil-military relations there.
But naming McChrystal's replacement, Petraeus, was considered a massive political move on Obama's part. Why?
Well, obviously, the president has a stake in winning this war. He's called it a war of necessity, and he called Iraq a war of, a choice. So if you're in a war of necessity, you certainly want to win it. It probably was the biggest foreign policy issue on his.
But hadn't McChrystal been successful in pursuing the war before? It was just simply that he made those indiscreet remarks that led to his being dismissed?
I think so. I think the president really wanted to make a strong statement to the military and to the general public about the state of civil-military relations and how things should work. For McChrystal, who, again, I respect immensely, I think it was kind of the straw that broke the camel's back. As you recall, he was a loose cannon,
and he had had trouble with other things. For example, earlier he was implicated in the cover-up of a great football player's death.
Right. He had been a wonderful tactical commander on the ground. He obviously understands the special operations aspect of the war. He understands counterinsurgency. He studied it, too. Maybe what he wasn't so good at was political savvy and kind of strategic diplomacy that a commander at that level needs to execute.
You also write about Mrs. Petraeus' response to the news that he was taking over. What did she say?
Well, Holly is just wonderful, and as you can imagine, she's been Mrs. Dad, for quite a few years.
But she also grew up in the military.
She did. Her father was a 4-star general, the superintendent at West Point, and Petraeus married her there. And her brother was a West Pointer, and another brother was enlisted and served in Vietnam, and their family has a history of the military, of working around the military. Their children are wonderful kids. Their youngest son, Stephen, is now joining the Army Rangers, and he was in Afghanistan while General Petraeus was there. So he was, concerned about his safety and welfare as well, but had obviously a stake in that war. Holly Petraeus, it's wonderful to see her blossom now that she has a chance to work for Treasury. And she does a lot for our wounded warriors and children of fallen warriors. But on that day, General Petraeus came out of the meeting with the president, and he summoned his personal security guard, Chief Mark Howell, and he said, "Howell, get Holly on the phone." Well, Holly was in a meeting, a lunch meeting, and had her phone off, so she got a voicemail and a couple of text messages and found out after the fact. I think that, it was hard for him not to be able to ask his wife before he went, but as you said, she grew up around the military, and she supports him, and she knows he's a public servant to the core. And as I said, in the book, in his mind, serving is winning. And so another chance to serve in the arena, to quote the Theodore Roosevelt speech that he loves to use. He was happy to go back in the arena, even though he was sad for General McChrystal.
In his address to Congress, General Petraeus outlined the 4 tasks he felt strategic leaders had to perform. And the first was to get the big ideas right. What do you mean by the big ideas?
The big idea was to get the right resources allocated for this war. As you recall, we had 160,000 troops in Iraq at the peak of the surge. We had less than 100,000 in Afghanistan. So he and the other military commanders and Secretary of Defense wanted to plus up those numbers of just boots on the ground.
Was this a way of also criticizing previous strategies, the Donald Rumsfeld strategy of trying to do both of these wars with as few dollars spent as possible?
Well, I think it was just an acknowledgement of the reality. It's expensive. It takes a lot of resources to conduct a war. And to do it right, you need to pour resources into it. We only have a finite number of troops. But it was more than just troops. It was a surge of ideas. And you've heard him say that before. The ideas were to implement the right kind of counterinsurgency approach that had a civil-military approach. So we had to get the State Department and other civilian agencies on board and work together. It's not easier said than done.
The reason I ask that is because it's my general sense, based on all the polls, that the military tends to support Republican politicians. And George Bush was the president who was responsible for going to both Afghanistan and Iraq, and many people feel did it with fewer resources than we should have. Soldiers were actually calling home and asking their parents to send them armor and things like that. Is the military really politicized? Do people wind up becoming Democrats or Republicans in the minds of the folks back in Washington?
In the minds of the folks back in Washington.
Well, you know, in other words, if I were in the White House, would I say, okay, where does this guy stand? Is he with us? Or
I'm sure you ask that. When you work in the White House, you look at everybody through that lens, naturally. If you work on the Hill, you look at everybody through that lens. But when you're in the Pentagon or when you're in Kabul or Kandahar, it's one team, one fight. And I've never experienced that in my 15 years of service. And I have great, you know, military friends that are hardcore Democrats and hardcore Republicans. And I don't, you know, there may be some whom I don't interact with. But in general, I think we try to avoid being political. Obviously, we're not even allowed to speak publicly about political views.
The big idea in Iraq seemed to be the surge, and it's credited as a strategy that turned the war around for the United States. Was that Petraeus's idea?
There was a sort of team of experts that came up with that idea, but he was influential. One of his mentors, General Keane, was involved. A number of think tankers at various institutes in Washington, D.C. were involved as well.
Effectively communicating those big ideas was another of his priorities. To whom did he want to communicate those ideas? Had communication been seen as a problem for his predecessors?
Well, relentless communication is one of his kind of key leadership approaches, I think. And by that, he means communicating with, you know, the president, with decision makers in Washington, D.C. on the status of the war and what the big ideas are and how we're going to implement them. It also means communicating to the domestic public so they understand. So that means engaging with the media. And he's not afraid of it. And I think something I've seen in my career in the military change is that more and more young officers and young soldiers are being educated on how to communicate and engage with the media. And you know, appropriately. Because a captain, a private first class can have the statement they make can have, you know, global repercussions. Their behavior can have global repercussions, as we saw in Abu Ghraib or this recent incident with the Marines. And so he uses various mediums, whether it's internet or engaging with the media. While he was in command in Afghanistan, he would hold this morning update brief and have it disseminated to the entire command. So he pushed it down and out. He pushed it laterally and up and out to all of the 49 other contributing nations that were there, up to NATO and, of course, back to Washington, D.C. So getting those ideas out and informing the command what the best practices are, what the worst practices are, and so forth is one of his key approaches.
Do you think that the public had lost any confidence in what they heard from the military during the Vietnam War when General Westmoreland kept on saying, we're winning when obviously we were not winning?
Yes, I think a lot of us, a lot of skeptics and pundits think back to those days and question. And that's why, you know, I think he encourages skeptics and pundits and, you know, supporters to come on over to the theater and check it out for themselves. And so that's one thing that really changed in Iraq was the invitation to all to come and see for themselves instead of just trusting the military statistics.
My guest is Paula Broadwell, who's written with Vernon Loeb, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. It's published by Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Paula Broadwell, who, with Vernon Loeb of The Washington Post, has written All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. It's published by the Penguin Press. Why All In?
I think the title sort of personifies his approach towards life. And whatever he does, he goes at it 110%. Fortunately, he has good health and good stamina. But the book also sort of, the book title also personifies, I think, how our troopers go at war. And you look at how their families back in the States are putting up with the 4th and 5th and 6th deployments, and their sacrifices are tremendous. So it's really, I was trying to capture the troops. And if you get into the depth of the book, you'll see there are several sub-characters who sort of show how counterinsurgency plays out and how difficult it is. And I'm trying to show how hard they work to make that happen.
And we've been hearing more and more about PTSD as a major consequence. Even if people escape it on their first time in Afghanistan or Iraq, it's likely to hit them the second or the third tour. So why are we sending them back so many times?
Well, I'm really grateful you've raised this issue of post-traumatic stress disorder, and I think it's something that's overlooked a little bit. But the USO has kicked off a campaign just today in public service announcements to bring attention to the 472,000 veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan who suffer from this. And they suffer...
That many, almost a half a million Americans.
Half a million Americans. And that is an epidemic, Leonard. And if we don't do something about it, it will impact our society. And, you know, what's happening, the side effects are a 30% increase in sexual crimes in that community, 40% increase in child abuse in that community.
Suicide
rates, you know, finally started to come down a little bit. But the military is grappling with this. General Dempsey, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has a team that works on it full time. There are a number of veteran support organizations out there. But I think that right now there's a real negative stigma attached to having PTSD, and a lot of folks don't come forward with it, and they don't know how to find their new normal. And I'm incidentally donating my book proceeds, a majority of proceeds, to a group called Team Red, White, and Blue that works to embrace these veterans and create a new spirit of camaraderie, a new group to belong to, and uses physical fitness to help them regain their new normal, if you will. So why do we keep sending them back? Well, they're willing to raise their hand and go again. I think you raised another good point. Sometimes it takes 8 or 10 years for this really to manifest. In some people, it happens right away. In others, they experience post-traumatic growth, and there may be something that sparks it, but they're able to get through it, and they're very resilient.
Although we're also seeing suicide of troops themselves while they're on duty. And that's a scary thing. That hasn't happened as much in previous wars, even some pretty awful wars. What is it about these two wars that have made them so difficult? Is it the IEDs? Is it the suicide bombers? Or is there something else going on here?
Well, I could read you a passage from the book I brought with, and it sort of explains, I think, what some of these troopers are seeing that makes it so difficult. And just to kind of summarize it, I spent a lot of time out in the field with these guys. I never saw this happen, but one troop, the field artillery regiment that were acting as an infantry unit, if you will, they were an infantillery. So artillerymen trying to be infantrymen out there on patrol, fighting the Taliban and trying to disarm IEDs and so forth. These guys get to the Arghandab River Valley in Kandahar in southern Afghanistan, and there's about 60 IEDs per 2 by 6 kilometer area. So every 50 feet or 60 feet or so. And they're walking on patrol, and one trooper steps on an IED, and his officer, his commander, turns around and sees him. He's laying on the ground. He lost 3 limbs. He's not bleeding. His body's shunting, which means it's shutting down and trying to preserve the heart, and his face is just frozen. And, you know, that young officer sees that. It doesn't matter what your rank is or your experience. You see that. That's a buddy. That's somebody you've been through a lot with, and you just grieve, and different people deal with it in different ways. So, you know, of course they try to resuscitate him and have to evacuate him. In the meantime, they're getting shot at, and, you know, just have lived through these incredible experiences that change you forever. So you can imagine, you know, even worse scenarios than that, mass casualty bombings, or, you know, recently what we've seen is infiltration by Afghan soldiers acting as suicide bombers. And, you know, they're working arm in arm with these guys, so that level of trust was there. It's been shattered. Fortunately, those are isolated incidents, but there are very real traumas of war.
Do you think that they are worse? Because we're after World War I and World War II, we talked about shell shock.
No, PTSD is no different now than before. I think it's just we didn't deal with it before. I don't know how the VA was dealing with it then, but we're making a concerted effort now. And
well, the role of the military has changed over the years. After World War II, the military wound up being engaged in all sorts of interaction with the civilians, but they weren't shooting at people at the same time. We started seeing changes in Bosnia and Kosovo, where soldiers were complaining that they were having to fight a war and also help people move their refrigerators from their shelled homes. And that's happened a lot here. And General Petraeus has really promoted the whole idea of working with locals. But has that caused some problems for soldiers whose training is basically to shoot at the enemy?
No, I think what you've seen is a very adaptive military. Obviously, we've been doing this since 2001, 2003 is when the real counterinsurgency efforts started to take off. And so, yes, soldiers leave the compound. They don't know if they're going to be greeted by a handshake or a hand grenade, or an IED for that matter. And so our system of training in the road to war, if you will, was updated several years ago. In fact, as I wrote in the book, General Petraeus was one of the senior officers who was instrumental in galvanizing that change. But our troopers are prepared for that. They don't always love it. But some of them do. There were several artillery guys that tried to change branch so that they could do this, you know, work more in this type of field. Not everybody loves it, and, you know, I just hope that we don't lose this skill now that we're drawing down and staying away from coin.
Well, General Petraeus moved many soldiers off of concentrated military bases and into the Afghan communities. Was that an example of his third task? We were talking about the four tasks. Mm-hmm. Implementing the big ideas?
Right. That's a prime example, Leonard. And getting out and living amongst the population so that troopers could protect them from the insurgents was a key idea, and that's how they implemented it.
And he's the author of the military's current manual on counterinsurgency. What has he come up with that's different from the approaches of the past?
Well, he oversaw that writing effort. It was a kind of combined team effort with the Marines, and there were some key historians that were involved, including Dr. John Nagel and Dr. Conrad Crane, and a team of experts that were from outside the military, because he wanted to sort of pursued that infotopia I was talking about early. He brought in human rights experts and media and so forth to kind of get the big ideas right there. As far as what ideas are new, I wouldn't say there are many new ideas. A lot of the concepts were drawn from, you know, previous doctrine and theories from French thoughts like David Galula and British experts on, you know, the counterinsurgency efforts in Malaysia and so forth. But what was new was adapting to the current environment. So you've got to deal with media. You've got to deal with the information war and the enemy's use of information, right, to recruit the population and so forth. You've got to deal with the mass casualties that IEDs can cause and so forth. So the weapons are different, the information systems are different, our intelligence platforms are different, and that's what the book does, that's what the field manual does. That said, it needs to be updated again, because Afghanistan's not Iraq. You know, each war is different, and we're learning more and adapting.
And that's always been a criticism of the military, that we're always fighting the previous war instead of the current war. The manual encourages troops to patrol on foot rather than in vehicles, and to remove, and I'm not sure I understand why. I do understand removing sunglasses when they speak to the locals.
Well, I think in that culture, eye contact is important, and that's a very basic sort of principle. Take off your glasses and look somebody in the eye. You know, and if you have it on, it's a barrier. Listen, these troops have a lot of gear when they're out there. Even when they're walking in these villages, and when I was walking in the villages, I had a flak vest and a Kevlar and protective armor. They even have titanium underwear for some of these guys because of the IED threat.
What does it feel like to be wearing titanium underwear?
I didn't try them on, Leonard, but we'll see if we can get you a pair.
Well, yes, wearing metal underwear must be really weird.
You know, a lot of troops are losing legs over there, so I think they don't really care what it feels like.
Now, Petraeus grew up in Cornwall, New York, which is just 7 miles from West Point. His father was an immigrant, but he served in World War II. Was it kind of preordained that Petraeus would go into the military?
It's fascinating to study his father a little bit. He was such an instrumental figure in his life, and I think the number one reason Petraeus is so driven, he wanted to please his father, and he couldn't please his father very easily. His father doled out what he called gruff love, and it was all about no excuses and results, boy. And we have a chapter called Results, Boy, and I think that's how Petraeus has approached his life, produce results. But his father was at sea when the Nazis invaded Holland, and he was actually a courier between New York and the Caribbean, so he wasn't going, you know, really in the war zone, if you will. But he couldn't go back to Holland. So he came back to New York, and he met a young lady, Miriam, at a reception for soldiers, sailors, and airmen. And he was recruited to join the U.S. Merchant Marines. So he left his, you know, homeland. He became a U.S. citizen. He quickly rose up the U.S. Merchant Marines, and then he was involved in the Murmansk runs. And if you recall, those were pretty deadly runs to resupply our allies, including the Soviets, to stop the Nazi war. So his father was recognized by the Russians just recently, about a decade ago before he died, for that sort of valiant effort. And, you know, Petraeus looked up to him and loved his stories of being at sea. He didn't join the Navy, obviously, but he admired his father's service and really came to love military history because of his father's appreciation for it. So back to Cornwall, there were a number of professors from West Point that lived there, a number of retired officers that lived there. There was a military prep school in town, and he happened to have dated a young woman whose father was in the Air Force, and really sort of thought West Point would be an ideal location. You know, it was sort of preordained, if you ask him or me.
He also, as you pointed out earlier, believed in getting a good education, wound up graduating near the top of his class wherever he went, although some of the greatest generals didn't do that at all. During his postgraduate studies, he spent time in Haiti after the U.S. took actions to reinstate Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Was that where he started thinking about nation building?
I think that was a key point in his life for understanding nation building. He, you know, quickly had to sort of figure out the situation on the ground. Had been looking at Haiti for some time, as a matter of fact. Before he went to Haiti, he was a fellow in the National Security Fellow Program at Georgetown and wanted to learn about it at the strategic level, and was actually asked to accompany Strobe Talbot to a principal's meeting. And he finally got the chance to raise his hand and go down to Haiti. He was identified by somebody on the staff who was trying to put together a team for Major General Kinzer at the time, and he jumped at it. So it was his first sort of look at dealing with development of rule of law. There weren't necessarily insurgents, but there was no order in Haiti at the time, so they had to deal with sort of that kind of that mayhem, if you will. And you know, they had to work on governance and capacity building for the Haitian government.
I mentioned Michael Hastings' book, but you also write about a passage in Bob Woodward's book, Obama's Wars, which was about how some officials questioned Petraeus' loyalty to Obama. What happened?
Well, I don't think he was not loyal to Obama at all. I think he was frustrated and felt like they looked at him as a Bush general, if you will, and he was. He was Bush's general. He was the face of the war for Iraq.
Then later Afghanistan.
And he was the face of the war for this president.
Two unpopular wars.
Right, and both presidents turned to him, and he, you know, he didn't flinch. Of course, as I said, he likes to be in the arena, and he likes to be in charge. You know, he likes to be the decision maker, but he believed in the strategy and thought it could work. I think what's interesting and what we try to trace in the book is the arc of his relationship with Obama. He was kind of an outside guy at the beginning of the book, but then the president selected him, you know, either as a scapegoat, which I don't believe, some say that, or as, you know, we're going to go all in, and if our best and brightest can't do it, then this war might not be winnable. But by the end of the story, you see them growing closer together, and now it's to watch while he's at the agency. You know, he's meeting with heads of state. He met with three heads of state last week. If you don't trust someone, why would you, you know, give them that position, that authority, and let them be a representative?
On the other hand, he really wanted to be chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, but Robert Gates told him he wasn't going to get that job.
He had mixed feelings about that position. I think that he saw what was coming next with the military, and that's a huge drawdown right now, and sort of a shift away from these large-scale wars because we can't afford them. It takes too long. There's, you know, no clear ending. What does win mean, right? So he had mixed feelings in the first place. But when he was told by Secretary Gates in the fall of 2010, it did sting because he hadn't put any sort of stipulations on taking that command, on stepping down, and, you know, taking a pay cut actually to go to Afghanistan. He was just willing to serve. But he didn't miss a beat. He proposed to Secretary Gates that that maybe the CIA directorship would be the best place for him. And I think it truly is. He's able to use his sort of cerebral scholarly background there, and it's awesome.
And also the fact that he's good at PR, heading an agency that's had a lot of PR problems over the years. It's been suggested that he might have a future in politics. Do you think he has those kinds of ambitions?
No, he certainly doesn't. And his favorite quote is, well, "What don't you understand about never?" Or what don't you understand about no? He
like General Sherman.
Exactly. He is a public servant at heart, and I think he enjoys being able to serve in that capacity and doesn't consider himself political.
Paula Broadwell has written with Vernon Loeb, All In, The Education of General David Petraeus. The book is published by the Penguin Press, and I want to thank you so much for being with us today. It's been a fascinating discussion.
Thanks for having me, Leonard, and a shout out to all our troops who are over there serving right now.